People interested in true crime are always baffled by the why. Why would someone do these things? What path in life could possibly have led them to commit such atrocious acts? In this podcast, we aim to explore the upbringings and backgrounds of some of history's worst criminals, but with a twist. Because we want you to set aside what you already know about them, we won't use their names until the end of the show, so you can listen anew and hopefully get insight into the question that haunts us the most. Why did they do it? Join us as we explore The Catalyst. It had been a lovely church service, she thought as she drove into her garage on that fateful Sunday morning. As the door noisily closed behind her, she gathered her purse and opened her door. Immediately, a terrible odor assaulted her, one she had never smelled before. She hurried into the house, covering her nose, calling for her grandson. After his grandmother asked what the awful smell could be, he sniffed the air and played down the concern. It was just the litter box, he explained. He would clean it soon. But his grandmother had had cats for a long time, and the litter box had never smelled like this before. The grandson changed his story. He had been experimenting with chemicals. His father was a chemist, after all, and there had been a smelly reaction. This explanation sufficed. It would be years later when the family realized that smell had actually been decomposing victims of the grandson, a man we'll refer to as the medic. The medic's parents married on August 22, 1959, but almost immediately the couple began to bicker. On one occasion, Mother Joyce stormed out of the house without shoes on, with 4 feet of snow on the ground. Walking 4 blocks down the street to a park, she sat on a bench until her husband Lionel came after her. Like many in Middle America, both of the medic's parents came from German heritage. Author Brian Masters writes in his book that this was virtually the only thing the couple had in common. At 23 years old, the medic's father was enrolled at Marquette University, studying chemistry. Lionel's wife, sometimes referred to as Rocky, was a few months older than he was. She worked as a telephone operator and had recently been promoted to a teletype machine instructor. Lionel was quiet, reserved, and analytical, while Joyce was emotional, and no reasoned argument could move her from her convictions, though it's worth noting, per Masters, that these descriptions came from a psychological interview with Lionel only. Masters asked for an interview with Joyce to balance the portrayal, but was denied. According to Lionel, his wife had a troublesome childhood with a severely alcoholic father, though Masters wrote that there was no documentation Joyce ever suffered any neglect at the hands of her parents. Lionel spent more time at work than at home. He and Joyce's marital problems were compounded when Joyce became pregnant soon after they married. Lionel, in his memoir, admits that neither of them were really prepared to be parents. He describes how the usual morning sickness steadily worsened into a continual state of nausea so severe that Joyce found it difficult to keep any food down at all. She soon found it necessary to quit her job as a teletype instructor. As the weeks passed for Joyce, home alone all day while Lionel went to work, she became increasingly nervous. Lionel describes how she found the slightest noise unbearable, and even the smells of cooking from the apartment downstairs were insufferable to her. Joyce demanded her husband do something, anything, about her torments. He writes that he always found it difficult to confront people and, in this instance, felt unable to confront their neighbors over completely normal noises and smells. He said that to him, none of the problems seemed very bad at all. When he refused to confront their neighbors, the couple argued, sometimes becoming heated. On one occasion, Joyce left the apartment altogether, walking to a nearby park, until Lionel pulled her off the bench and walked her back. According to him, Joyce asked him if he loved her, but his reassurances didn't seem to satisfy her. He said in his memoir that his way of showing intimacy was by working and providing for their growing family, But that wasn't what his wife needed. 2 months before the medic's birth, Joyce's nerves had become so frayed that the couple moved in with Lionel's parents in West Allis, Wisconsin. While this alleviated the noise issues, Joyce's condition didn't improve. Her nausea continued, now joined by a form of rigidity that doctors couldn't explain. Her legs would lock and her body would go rigid as if she were having a seizure, but she wasn't diagnosed with a seizure disorder. In fact, the doctors couldn't find any medical reason for her attacks, instead giving her injections of barbiturates and morphine to relax her. Assuming her attacks were psychological in origin, another doctor added phenobarbital to her medications, but the drug cocktail didn't seem to help. Lionel writes that she became increasingly tense and irritable, while acknowledging that the circumstances at home likely didn't help. As a graduate student, Lionel left at 7 a.m. and often didn't return until 8 in the evening. In the intervening hours, Joyce was forced to remain home with her mother-in-law. Without a driver's license, she had no means of escaping the house. In his writings, Lionel doesn't seem sympathetic to his wife. To him, the situation seemed tolerable. At one point, she was taking as many as 26 pills a day while still pregnant with the medic. Lionel was at school when he received word that Joyce was in labor in May 1960. The phone rang around 4:45 in the afternoon, and it was his mother telling him his father had taken Joyce to the hospital a few blocks from his school. Leaving immediately, he discovered that the medic had already been born by the time Lionel arrived. He describes the first few days of the medic's life as blissful. Joyce's difficult pregnancy was over, and they were happily spending time with their new baby. Of course, that bliss was short-lived. Within days, problems rose again. Joyce was pressured to breastfeed when that wasn't her choice. Eventually, she was allowed to bottle feed the medic, but other problems arose. The family of three were crammed into a single bedroom in Lionel's parents' home. Joyce fought with her mother-in-law, settling into a constant state of tension. Eventually, Joyce refused to join the rest of the family for dinner, instead remaining in the bedroom with the medic. When the medic was 4 months old, the tension hit an all-time high, and it became impossible to remain with Lionel's parents. At the beginning of September, they moved into an old house that had been divided into six separate apartments. The house was adjacent to a working-class part of town with many families, small inexpensive restaurants, and ice cream parlors. Lionel calls it the sort of place where a struggling graduate student could live with his wife and child with a reasonable sense of safety. They rented a one-bedroom apartment in the building 5 miles away from Lionel's university. He continued with his degree while Joyce stayed home with the medic. Their relationship was a mixture of good and bad, Lionel says in his memoir, with Joyce seemingly settling into a role of wife and mother. The medic was a typical, bubbly, likable child who played with stuffed animals and wooden blocks. In September 1962, Lionel was offered a graduate assistantship in a PhD program at Iowa State University. Accepting, the family moved to the university's campus in Ames, Iowa, and set up house in a small wooden home owned by the university. It had been smaller than their old apartment. It had been built during World War II as emergency housing. Even with a small house, the university offered a generous stipend for the assistantship, so Lionel and Joyce saw this as a step toward a better future for them. But Joyce still didn't have a driver's license, meaning she had no choice but to remain in the house while Lionel spent long hours at the lab working toward his degree. This, again, took a toll on her mental health. And again, Lionel approached her problems with an analytical mind rather than as a supportive husband. Their arguments grew heated and, at times, physical. On at least one occasion, Joyce grabbed a kitchen knife and made jabbing motions toward Lionel. When she became physical, he says he would go into another room or leave the house altogether. To make matters worse, the medic had several childhood infections, one after another. He often contracted ear or throat infections that would keep him up every night, crying from the pain. For treatment, he was taken to the university clinic for injections. He often lashed out at the nurses and doctors who treated him. But Lionel insists there were good times with the medic, too. Describing him as happy and expressive, he said the medic loved to ride with him on a bicycle. During one ride, the medic made his father stop the bike and focused on something Lionel couldn't see. Upon closer examination, he found a nighthawk had fallen from its nest onto the hard pavement. They took the bird home and nursed it back to health at his son's urging. Once it was healed, the trio released it, with Lionel calling it the single happiest moment of the medic's life. Perhaps as a way of explaining his own parenting skills, Lionel writes that as a child, he had an obsession with fire that grew into a fascination with explosives. He explains that his obsession had become so all-encompassing that he nearly burned down a neighbor's garage on one summer afternoon. It was then that Lionel's father learned of his dangerous impulses and gave him a stern lecture on the dangers of fire. Lionel knew he had to channel and control those feelings, even if it took every ounce of his will. Lionel figured that just as his own father was naive about his childhood feelings toward fire, Lionel was likely naive about the obsessions developing in his son, too. While still living on the campus of the Iowa State University, Lionel noticed a foul smell coming from beneath the house. Taking a flashlight and a plastic bucket with him, he climbed under the house and found a large pile of bones. He identified them as the remains of various small rodents that had probably been killed by local civets, a close relative to the skunk. He gathered the bones into a bucket and climbed out from under the house. Joyce and the medic were waiting for him. While Lionel was talking to Joyce, the medic took many of the bones from the bucket and stared at them. He picked them up and dropped them back into the pile over and over again, seemingly thrilled by the sound they made. At the time, Lionel believed the incident to simply be a childish episode, but he would later see them in a more sinister and macabre light. Lionel describes their time in Iowa mainly in terms of his graduate work and spending little time with his son. He barely noticed the changes his son was going through because his focus was almost exclusively on the enormous amount of work required for his PhD. But one day in the spring of 1964, everything was brought to a standstill when the medic complained of a tender spot in his groin area. As the pain worsened, a small bulge appeared in his scrotum, causing his parents to immediately take him to the doctor. Diagnosing the medic with a double hernia, the doctor explained it was the result of a birth defect and surgery was needed to correct the problem. The procedure scheduled for the following week, the medic chose to take a ragged stuffed dog he'd had since he was 2 to accompany him to the hospital. When he awoke after the surgery, the pain was so fierce, he asked Joyce if they had cut off his penis. His recovery was slow, with Lionel writing that the medic moved like an old man, his energy drained. His parents assumed the initial dip in his mood that followed the surgery would be short-lived, but that wasn't the case. It seemed to be becoming permanent. 2 years later, when Lionel was nearly finished with his degree, his son's dark mood seemed to manifest physically. As he grew inward, his hair grew darker, as did the shading of his eyes. The medic sat quietly for long periods, his face oddly motionless. Lionel wonders in his memoir whether his mind was already full of the terrifying fantasies that would consume him in adulthood. But at the time, Lionel only saw a quiet little boy. He was too busy to see much else. He received his PhD in October 1966 and, in November, took a job as a research chemist for a large chemical company in Akron, Ohio. The family moved into a small house in Doylestown, the largest home they had lived in up to that point. When they moved, Joyce was pregnant again with the same problems that plagued her the first time. Their home was a duplex, so noisy neighbors bothered her, and she became nervous and irritable. Lionel writes that she took 2 to 3 tranquilizers every day. When that didn't seem to help, the dosage was increased to 3 to 5 tablets per day. She withdrew from social activities, isolating herself until their second child was born in December 1966. As with their first child, Lionel spent most of his time working at his new job, calling the lab a great relief from the chaos at home. Their second son, David, suffered from colic, keeping them up night after night for months, increasing the tension in the house. This only served to deepen Joyce's depression, keeping her in bed most days. This meant that the majority of childcare fell to Lionel, who wanted nothing more than to spend as much time at work as possible. The medic reluctantly began school at Hazel Harvey Elementary School in Doylestown. According to Lionel, the medic had developed a fear that other people might harm him. He resented his parents for making a move from Iowa. The prospect of going to school frightened and unnerved him. On his first day, he appeared terrified and speechless. His first grade teacher described the medic as inordinately shy and reclusive. While he followed instructions and did what was asked of him, he didn't engage with the other children, not even on the playground. At the time, Lionel didn't see this as problematic. He himself had been shy as a child, and besides, being shy in a new town seemed a pretty normal reaction for a kid. The family moved again when the medic was 7, this time to a rented house in Barberton. The medic met a boy named Lee, who lived behind them. They played together and even went trick-or-treating together that Halloween. In addition to Lee, the medic developed a fondness for an assistant teacher when he was in the 3rd grade. When asked later why he liked this particular woman, the medic shrugged and said, "She was nice to me, I guess." One Saturday, he and his father gathered a bowl of tadpoles and gave them to the teacher as a gift. When she accepted them graciously, the medic later found out that the teacher had given the tadpoles to Lee. The medic snuck into Lee's garage and poured motor oil into the bowl, killing the tadpoles. In Lionel's words, this was the medic's first act of violence. Over the next few years, the medic changed for the worse. Lionel describes how, at 10, his son was more relaxed and loose-limbed, but by 15, he had become strangely rigid and inflexible. His legs appeared to lock at the knees, causing his feet to scrape across the ground as if he were dragging them. If you're like me, your mind likely jumped to, "Hey, locked knees sounds a lot like what the medic's mother experienced while she was pregnant with him." And yet, it doesn't seem anyone else drew the parallel. Anyway, the medic's shyness only increased, evidenced by the way he tensed anytime someone approached him. That tension manifested as he would grab a small stick or a piece of grass and begin to wind it nervously around his fingers. Lionel tried to get his son interested in sports like soccer or tennis, but when that didn't work, his father suggested a more solitary pastime. He bought his son a professional bow and arrow and set up a target in an open field. The medic initially showed interest, but quickly became bored, returning to his bedroom to stare at the ceiling. Lionel writes that by the time his son reached 15, he had tried and abandoned almost everything that interested most boys his age. Nothing appealed to the medic until Lionel suggested bodybuilding, which had worked for him in his youth. He hoped it would increase his son's self-confidence and reduce his shyness. The medic took an immediate interest, especially after his father brought home a bull worker, a tool to do isometric exercises. Over the following weeks, the medic seemed more engaged than his father had seen him for a long time. Bodybuilding occupied him for a year, allowing him to hone his upper body strength, but then the magic faded. The medic abandoned the bull worker just as he had all his other fleeting interests. While Lionel thought at this point that his son had no interest, he later learned that the medic's fascination with bones was only increasing. While his father was at work and his mother was in bed, he would roam the streets with his pockets full of plastic bags. He was on the hunt for animal remains, creating a collection that he would turn into his own cemetery. Once he found an animal carcass, he stripped the remaining flesh from the bones. And when he found a dead dog, he mounted the head on a stake. As the medic's fascination grew, his parents' marriage continued falling apart. Lionel says the marriage had been in a steady decline since 1970. Joyce's ailments only continued to compound upon each other, and she took increasingly higher doses of medication to combat them. Her doctors ordered an extensive series of medical tests, hoping to find the cause of her distress, but they found nothing. Diagnosed with having an anxiety state, she was referred to a psychiatrist, but the sessions didn't seem to help. Finally, in July of 1970, she was admitted to the psychiatric ward of Akron General Hospital for severe anxiety. But believing there was nothing mentally wrong with her, Joyce checked herself out 3 days later. She found herself back in the hospital a few months after that, this time staying for a month. After her release, she attended group therapy sessions where she made friendships and maintained those friendships even after she left the group. Lionel writes in his memoir that Joyce improved in other ways. She began to craft, working with glass and macrame, and sold some of her goods in nearby Bath, Ohio. Over the next few years, their marriage was a roller coaster. Lionel describes it as rejuvenation and collapse. During eras of rejuvenation, Joyce learned how to drive and took classes at Akron University. They even took a vacation to Puerto Rico. But in the relationship's valleys, she withdrew from whatever social life she had built. Whether they were in a hill or a valley, neither parent paid much attention to the medic. Whenever Lionel spoke to his son, the medic was passive, accepting whatever his father suggested. Eventually, the distance between them grew so much that they could barely speak directly to each other. In the summer of 1977, after returning from her father's funeral, Joyce told Lionel that their marriage was over. Lionel would learn later she'd had an affair. As the medic was nearly 18, the subsequent custody battle was only about their younger son, David. Lionel moved to a nearby motel, while Joyce and their sons remained in the house. The following summer, after the divorce was finalized, Lionel and his new girlfriend, Sherry, stopped by the house for a visit. He expected to find the whole family there, but instead, he found his oldest son in a house full of teenagers. The medic told his father that Joyce and David had moved out. Sherry's first impression of the medic was of a lost little boy who had been shell-shocked by his parents' divorce. She walked through the house and found a broken refrigerator and very little food. Appalled at the situation, Lionel and Sherry immediately moved into the house. According to Sherry, the medic was kind and helpful as the couple moved in. Everything seemed to be improving, at least until one day when Sherry stopped by in the middle of the day and found the medic, then 17, drunk in his room. By the time Lionel arrived home, his son was passed out on his bed. Shocked that his son had a drink at all underage, much less enough drinks to pass out from intoxication, Lionel later dressed down the medic, whose response was to shrug and explain he drank out of boredom. Over the next few weeks, Lionel didn't see any further evidence of drinking, but two of Sherry's rings disappeared. When confronted, the medic denied he had anything to do with the missing jewelry and got up to leave. Sherry ordered him to sit back down. She later told Lionel that she saw a flash of terrifying rage in the medic's eyes. It was just after his high school graduation that the medic committed his first murder. Only 18, he picked up a hitchhiker named Stephen Hicks, who was the same age. According to the New York Times, Hicks had left his home to hitchhike at a concert at Chippewa Lake Park. The medic would later confess to picking up Hicks and taking him back to his empty house for beers. When Hicks eventually tried to leave, the medic strangled him, then dismembered him, later scattering the bones in the woods behind his home. Unbeknownst to him, Lionel would walk through the same woods that held Stephen's bones for years before his son's crimes were discovered. At this point, however, Lionel had no idea what his son was up to. In fact, he thought his stern parenting had even put the medic on the right track. Soon, the medic was packing his bags for college, with Lionel professing relief that his son was miles away at Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. He even visited his son, relieved by the happy facade the medic projected. But Lionel soon knew all was not as well as it had seemed when his son's grades arrived at the end of the first quarter, followed by the medic himself. With a GPA of 0.45, he would not return to college, so Lionel told him he had to get a job or join the military. After failing to get several jobs, but succeeding in getting a drunk and disorderly arrest, the medic joined the Army in January of 1979 at the age of 19. At his wit's end, Lionel had set up the interview himself and drove his son to the recruiting office. Within a few weeks, the medic was off to boot camp. After a short trip home upon completing boot camp, the medic was deployed to a U.S. Army base in West Germany. There, he trained and served as a combat medic, according to a 1991 Deseret News article. David Rodriguez, quoted in the article, remembered the medic as a quote-unquote gin-swilling wimp during their time bunking together from 1979 to 1981. Lionel writes that when his son's discharge papers arrived shortly after his footlocker, there was a code on the papers that indicated the medic was discharged because of his alcoholism. Mustered out in North Carolina, the medic first went to Miami, but soon ran out of money. Lionel and Sherry refused to send money, only a plane ticket to Cleveland to come home. When he arrived, he was drunk, filthy, and disheveled. As had become his new routine, the medic cleaned himself up before hitting another low, another drunk and disorderly arrest at a Ramada Inn. Out of options, Lionel and Sherry decided that the medic should visit Lionel's mother, Catherine, in West Dallas, Wisconsin. In his memoir, Lionel remembers this time with hope. His son appeared to be adjusting quite well to living with his grandmother. The medic cared for Catherine, mowed her grass, cared for her garden, and did her shopping and house cleaning. He attended church with her, and she told Lionel that there was a woman at church who seemed interested in the medic. He had even gotten a job, something he hadn't managed in Ohio. He was a phlebotomist at a blood plasma center and was attending AA meetings, all spelling a life on the upswing. Now, Catherine did have some concerns, but she worried how her son Lionel would react, so she went to Sherry with them instead. She reported that she had found a male store mannequin among her grandson's things. Despite the subterfuge, word reached Lionel anyway, so he called his son and asked him about it. The medic's response was calm and unemotional, telling his father he had taken it from the store just to prove to himself that he could. Lionel insisted the medic return the mannequin, but his son said he had already thrown it out. While Lionel didn't see anything else to do, Sherry was deeply disturbed by the theft, saying that no young man the medic's age should have a male mannequin in his closet. His disturbing behavior began to escalate from there. According to author Masters, in 1982, he was arrested for indecent exposure at the Wisconsin State Fair Park. He was convicted and fined $50. He subsequently lost his job as a phlebotomist and was unemployed for more than 2 years. Lionel offered to get his son established in an independent sales job, like Amway, but the medic had a noncommittal response. Soon, Catherine was calling to tell Lionel and Sherry that she'd found a gun under her grandson's bed, and on another occasion, she had seen him with a man who appeared to be so drunk he wasn't able to walk. In addition to this, she told Sherry about the horrible odors she smelled in her garage. The medic told Lionel he had found a dead raccoon and wanted to conduct experiments on it with various chemicals. Lionel says in his memoir that he let himself believe his son, however implausible it seemed. The medic finally found work in January 1985 when he was hired as a mixer working the overnight shift at a chocolate factory. Shortly after beginning this job, he began to frequent the city's gay bars, bathhouses, and bookstores. While he found the bathhouses to be relaxing, he grew frustrated at his sexual partners when they moved during sex. According to a 1991 Vanity Fair article, the medic would drug his partners' drinks to make them unconscious during sex. After doing this 12 times, his membership to the bathhouse was revoked, and he had to find another place to drug unwitting partners. He was still living with his grandmother in November 1987 when he committed the murder that would serve as a catalyst for 15 additional murders. A few days before Thanksgiving, the medic met Stephen Toomey and convinced him to join him for the evening at the Ambassador Hotel in Milwaukee. He would later profess he had no intention of killing Toomey, only drugging and sleeping with him as he had done a dozen times before. But when he woke up the following morning, he found Toomey dead, his chest caved in and blood on his mouth. The medic left the hotel and returned with a newly bought large suitcase. He shoved Toomey's body into it before taking it back to his grandmother's house. He waited a week before he dismembered Toomey's body and disposed of the remains, minus the head, in the trash, according to Masters. He kept Toomey's head, boiling it in a laundry detergent and bleach, hoping to remove the flesh, but the chemicals made the skull too brittle, so he disposed of that as well. According to an article from the San Antonio News, after the second murder, his obsession with the dead went into full swing. He admitted that the compulsion seemed too strong, and he didn't even try to stop it after Toomey's murder. Over the next 4 years, 15 men and boys of color fell victim to the medic. Even when the police were called, he convinced them the drug person was his lover, and the police accepted that and left. On one occasion, the police left a drugged 14-year-old boy with the medic even after smelling a foul odor in his apartment. He would go on to kill the 14-year-old and at least one more person. On July 22, 1991, a man who had gone home with the medic and escaped his clutches flagged down two Milwaukee police officers. They accompanied him back to the apartment where the officers, while looking for keys to the handcuffs the victim still wore, found Polaroids of human remains in various stages of dismemberment. After resisting arrest, the medic was cuffed before a more thorough search was conducted. Police found what has been described as a horror scene as they searched. In his bedroom, they found seven skulls. In his refrigerator were two human hearts and a portion of arm muscle. They also found an entire torso, plus a bag of human organs and flesh that had frozen to the ice in the freezer. By the time the search was over, investigators had found two entire skeletons, a pair of severed hands, two severed penises, and a mummified scalp. In the medic's bedroom sat a 57-gallon drum that held three dismembered torsos slowly dissolving in an acid solution. In a profile, coroner Jeffrey Jensen said searching the crime scene was eerily like dismantling someone's museum. As many of you have guessed by now, the medic, the curator of this macabre museum, is Jeffrey Dahmer. Waiving his right to an attorney, the former combat medic confessed to the murders of 16 men and boys in Wisconsin since 1987, later adding the 1978 murder of Stephen Hicks in Ohio. As part of his confession, he admitted to killing his victims, having sex with their corpses, and then dismembering their remains. According to Masters, he also confessed to having consumed the hearts, liver, biceps, and a portion of thigh of three victims. The remains found in his refrigerator were intended for consumption, and he told police he typically prepared his meals with various condiments. On February 15, 1992, Dahmer was ruled to be sane and convicted of 15 murders. 2 days later, he was sentenced to life imprisonment for each conviction, as Wisconsin didn't have the death penalty. It had been abolished in 1853. 4 months after his Wisconsin sentencing, in Ohio, he was convicted and sentenced to another life imprisonment for the murder of Stephen Hicks. He was sent to the Columbia Correctional Institution in Wisconsin to serve his sentences. But in November 1994, he was bludgeoned to death by another prisoner, Christopher Scarver. According to the Wilmington Star News, Scarver told prison officials God had told him to do it. All but Dahmer's brain was cremated in September 1995 and divided between his parents. The reason his brain was left out of the equation was because his parents couldn't agree whether to donate it for study. Ultimately, Dahmer's brain was also cremated. The apartment complex where Dahmer killed 12 of his 17 victims was demolished in November 1992 and now sits as an empty lot. Plans have been made and discarded to turn that site of horrors into a memorial garden, a playground, or even new housing. Instead, it continues to sit vacant, a lasting scar of the tragedies committed there. This episode was researched by writer and historian Jen Erdman. Sources for this episode include The Shrine of Jeffrey Dahmer by Brian Masters, A Father's Story by Lionel Dahmer, and The Jeffrey Dahmer Story, An American Nightmare by Don Davis. Also referenced were articles from The New York Times, The Deseret News, The Crime Library, My Son Antonio, The Akron Beacon Journal, and The Bend, Oregon Bulletin. The Catalyst is a production of Grab Bag Collab, created and engineered by Amanda Rossman and narrated and edited by Amber Hunt. You can support us and our other programs at patreon.com/grabbagcollab. That's GRABBAGCOLLAB. Special thanks to Daisy Egan for being our first pass editor and a collaborator on Grab Bag. Music comes from Soundstripe Inc., my dad, Bruce Hunt, and my son, Hunt Van Benskoden.